Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Yes, it's live, it's today, it's Sunday, it's a hurricane. It's Hurricane Sandy bearing up the East Coast towards New York City. And we are burning down the house, nevertheless. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, and today we're doing a little experiment by doing this by the wonders of telecommunication. I, in my bunker, deep below the streets of Manhattan, and joining us also by the wonders of telecommunication is Richard Yancey, who is the director of Green Light New York, a non-for-profit organization, reading from their website, independent non-profit organization whose mission is to promote quality, energy-efficient lighting in New York City. Richard, are you there?
I am. Hi, Curtis.
Hey, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
It's been a long time in coming, and I'm glad that we could finally synchronize our schedules. Tell us about your group. Tell us about what we New Yorkers can do by knowing more about better ways to light our houses and our apartments and our places of work.
Sure. Well, I can tell you, by way of doing that, let me introduce Green Light New York a little bit. Green Light was a brainchild of the Bloomberg administration along with the Natural Resources Defense Council as part of their big Plan YC master plan, which they came out with in 2007, a 25-year master plan for New York. Really all aspects of planning, but a lot of the overlay on top of all of it was about sustainability and energy efficiency. And a bunch of laws came out of that called the Greener Greater Building Plan, which we can talk about a little later. But some initiatives came out of that too, and one of them was to create an energy efficient resource center for New York, and that's what Green Light New York is. So it got spun out at the end of 2009 as an independent nonprofit. And we have been working with the public sector and some foundations and also now the private sector to raise the money to create this energy efficiency resource center where people will be able to go and take classes, meet with experts, to get advice on actual technology and also on some of the incentives and rebates out there and also what's required by code. And also see this stuff, so a demonstration in the mock-up space, which is a really key component because especially when it comes to lighting, it's, I think, very confusing to know the difference between the different types of lighting and what's energy efficient versus what's just plain old bad lighting. And that's really one of the things that we're trying to overcome is create a place where people can see this stuff.
That's great. So is there a there yet? For green light?
We're getting really close. The city, this being kind of one of their initiatives, is we're working with them to occupy a space in Lower Manhattan on Chambers Street. We have a design team, a great design team that's been working on the contract documents to create this space. It'll be about 6,000 square feet. And while we're doing all that, we're also putting in place the last kind of funding push pieces, which is really reaching out to the private sector to raise the rest of the money we need to start construction. If everything goes well, we hope to break ground early next year and be up and running in the kind of late spring, early summer of 12.
Oh, wait. Break ground sounds very ominous. I thought you were going to be in the Tweed Courthouse.
Well, it's a metaphorical breaking of ground. We're going to be across the street, actually, from the Tweed Courthouse in the old surrogate courthouse. It's a beautiful historic building. Actually, I think one of the city's first landmarks.
What entities in the private side are funding? Let's give them some props.
Well, we are talking to the lighting industry and have quite a few tentative commitments that we'll be able to announce shortly. We're talking to the design community and, again, have quite a few tentative commitments kind of from the professional community, so the architecture community, the lighting design community, the contracting and engineering community, too. And then we're also reaching out to
funding from Con Ed?
Well, that's really part of our public, our kind of, we kind of put that in our utility public sector funding. So we have a bunch of funding from NYSERDA, the New York State Energy Efficiency Resource Administration, and some from the state and also some from the city itself. And then we have some foundation money from the Kresge Foundation, the Mertz Gilmore Foundation, and then we actually have a lot of foundation money early on, some seed funding from a bunch of other foundations as well.
And so in addition to your physical presence in Manhattan, tell us exactly where this is going to be located.
31 Chambers Street. So it's Chambers Street at right near the Manhattan Municipal Building, 1 Center Street, kind of back across from the Tweed Courthouse and City Hall.
Courthouse.
No, actually, that it's the building, I think, that the Tweed Courthouse was modeled after, but then didn't get all the lavish finishes that this building did, and that's hence the scandal of the courthouse itself.
Okay. So 31 Chambers Street in Manhattan. Now, will you have an online presence for those of us, and there are many all over the world who might like to learn what New York has learned?
Right. Right now we have kind of a rudimentary website just telling you about the organization. We're in the middle, actually, of revamping that. So we'll have a place which will be a repository of information, including, you know, a bunch of our studies that we're doing, our classes, and we'll be able to set those up as we move forward in kind of webcast format, so that we'll be able to deliver, I think, education in a relatively robust way. I think one of the main pushes to have this thing be physical is really to also be a place where you can come and actually see lighting and make better decisions on it. You know, as opposed to some of the other energy efficient things you can do, whether it's a more efficient, you know, mechanical system or curtain wall, doesn't require the kind of the seeing of the actual light and see how it interacts in space to understand it so well. And one of the things we're trying to help avoid by that is some of the blowback that's happened when certain technologies have been rolled out too quickly and really get chosen for potentially not very suitable applications.
I'm just curious, what would be an example of that?
Well, compact fluorescent bulbs, I think, are a really good example of that. You know, when they first came out, they were being pushed very hard before the technology was really mature enough to be something that I think most people, you know, would find acceptable. And so people, I think, had a lot of negative reaction to the quality of the light, the color of light, the controllability or dimmability of the light. And so they may have tried one early, got burned, and decided they weren't going to use them ever again. And the fact is, right now, the technology is you know, is much more sophisticated and is much better across the board.
Yeah. If you've just tuned in, this is Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network, and we're speaking with Richard Yancey, who's the director of Greenlight New York. Yeah, I remember the early days of CFLs, and they've been around since the 1980s, mm-hmm. and they were kind of wimpy, mm-hmm. but they're so much improved now that they're even dimmable, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of them are, that's right. Not all of them, but most of them are now.
Yeah, and I've got dimmable CFLs in my house, and I've got even cold cathode some cold cathode, but with medium base screw-in lamps. I'm just trying them out because I'm told they have a lifespan of practically forever.
Mm-hmm.
I've been trying to weed my stock of old Edison incandescents out. I don't even have... Oh, I have one lamp that's got a halogen.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll be able to educate people about the energy trade-offs with all these different sorts of light sources, yeah?
Yeah, you'll be able to go and see the actual sources, compare them and contrast them, understand what their costs are, what their efficiency are, what the kind of return on investment of doing, you know, a relamp or a retrofit project will be, and just be able to, you know, talk to some folks and also to physically experience it. So, and also it'll be a place where I think, you know, either entrepreneurs or manufacturers will be able to set up temporarily something they're working on and get a chance to show it off to people, and people can kind of see what's coming down the pike, too.
Yeah, that's good. Or even architects, that we can bring our clients and say, hey, look, it's not going to be so bad, right?
Yeah. And I think that's one of the real potential, as it gets used more, potential benefits is for kind of design teams to be able to test different solutions and bring, you know, people who are going to be making decisions on this stuff through to really understand those trade-offs and understand the solutions better, instead of getting the whole thing built in place and then having someone who's not really happy with the way it turned out and having to figure it out then.
Good. Will you be able to have any sort of information or demonstrations about daylighting schemes?
Yeah, actually there is. There's a couple ways that that's going to take place. For the design community, there'll be something called a heliodon, which is actually something that's relatively simple. It's a table with a large lamp at a distance from it that kind of replicates the sun, and you can tilt the table to replicate the kind of relationship of the platform to the sun, either by time of day, time of year, or location. And by bringing a kind of an old-school architectural model and sticking it on the heliodon, you'll be able to actually see, because light is totally scalable, you'll be able to see, you know, different orientations, different facade treatments, the actual amount of light, how deeply it penetrates into the space, and really see that in a real demonstrable way. There'll also be a series of models that will show kind of different approaches to daylight design, including, you know, different size fenestration, different size windows, and how that affects it, different types of light shelves and sun shading devices, and how that affects it. So there'll be some actual kind of physical models and tools that you'll either be able to use or see to better understand daylight design, as well as just having people on staff who can help guide the process and answer questions.
I suppose then the big question that anybody's going to ask is, you know, okay, there are 8 million people in New York City, and there are over 100,000 buildings, and there are millions of apartments and millions of houses. So if everybody got rid of their incandescent lighting and used more daylight and used more efficient sources of artificial illumination, what is the potential for the city of New York? Has anybody estimated what the maximum possible reduction in energy use might be?
Well, that's been looked at a couple different ways. So if you look at it just from what it is now, you know, of our, whatever it is, $15 billion energy bill, $3.4 billion or so is lighting. It accounts for 27% of our total electric use, 17% of our total energy, and represents about 12% of our carbon footprint. So it's got a big impact or potential impact out there. And actually, a couple years ago, Con Ed had a study looking at all of New York City electric use, so just the electricity use, and what the energy efficient, you know, saving opportunities were. So they looked at kind of, you know, cooling, appliances, heating, refrigeration, and where the realistic potential was. 60% of the realistic potential was all in lighting. And if we as a city were to capture that potential, we could be saving about $700 million a year in electricity costs.
Well, that's good. And what does that mean in terms of megawatts or gigawatts of electricity, and how does that compare with the generating capacity that we have presently in the city? Because, as I understand it, we're getting a lot of our electricity from, or a significant portion from hydroelectric, most of which we're buying from Hydro-Quebec. And then, of course, and there's also a huge chunk of our electric supply that comes from the Indian River Atomic Power Plant up the Hudson, yeah, which might actually be decertified next year, which would leave us in potentially dire straits. So how does that dollar figure into actual, you know, kilowatts, megawatts, or gigawatts of power? Do you have stats on that?
You know, I'm trying to remember what my stats are. I think it's about 3,000. I'm going to misspeak here. I want to say it's 3,000 gigawatts. I think that's about what it is.
Wow.
And so it's interesting you bring up Indian Point, and you were talking about daylight design earlier. I think one of the things that we're kind of focusing in on initially is commercial lighting, where that's the biggest energy use in a commercial building is its lighting. It's over a third of all of its energy use. And this has to do partially to be working in concert with the Green Integrated Building Plan laws, which we can talk about in a minute. But the other thing that we're doing concurrent with this is we're doing this daylighting potential study that was kind of instigated both by the mayor's office and the Natural Resources Defense Council, which is looking at, you know, if we were to put in daylight controls in all of these office buildings, and particularly in Manhattan, how much power could we save? And really, there's this huge opportunity to reduce our peak demand, which is one of the key wedges in terms of Indian Point. Because peak demand, you know, meaning, you know, hot summer day, high noon, you know, the air conditioners are blasting and everyone still has their lights on. Well, if we can take some of that energy out of the grid by turning the lights off or dimming them way down, then we don't have to build as much power plants to meet that, you know, ultimate peak demand. So there's a huge opportunity in kind of daylight design and really capitalizing on daylight controls in reducing the peak demand too.
And part of that, I would think, Richard, is that there has to be a lot of education that goes along with being able to achieve that.
You know, Curtis, it's really interesting. One of the most, maybe it shouldn't be surprising, but facts about doing this study has been going around and looking at, you know, some buildings and case studies that have some not so sophisticated and some very sophisticated controls in place, or control systems in place to dim the lights during the middle of the day when along the perimeter of the building when there's enough daylight out there and making its way into the building that you don't need your electric lights on. But those systems are really potentially fabulous, but I think the big trick there is making sure they're working and making sure the occupants understand them and making sure on an ongoing basis they're being, you know, commissioned and tuned over time, because a lot of what happens is sometimes these systems go in and then there's no kind of steward of the system and the people who put them in aren't there anymore and they just aren't functioning. And they either aren't functioning at all or they aren't functioning at the capacity that they could be.
Right.
So I think education is a huge, huge piece of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, the direction that I was trying to lead you... And by the way, this is Heritage Radio Network, Bernie in the House, and we're speaking with Richard Yancey of Greenlight New York. Because, you know, people drop in and out of these podcasts. In any case, what I was leading towards was the necessity, in my mind, of educating across the board, and maybe it has to start with kids who are 8 or 9 years old right now, having lights on all over the place, in spaces that you're not in, or uniformly illuminating every corner of your space, not just what you're inhabiting, but everything, is not the way that we need to be living or working or going to school going forward.
I totally agree with you. I mean, I think, there was a time during the oil crisis in the 70s where you had to turn off the light stickers on all the little toggle switches, and I think all of us were, who grew up then were pretty conscious about turning lights off. And so I think there is a huge behavioral part to this that is a lot about just people taking a little bit more control over their own environment and, only using as much light as they need to, because at the end of the day, the most efficient light is the one that's turned off. But at the same time, the codes are slowly moving in that direction, too. I mean, you have these office floors which might only be able to be switched on and off by, a couple breakers. Moving from, a very crude way of lighting our spaces, which is kind of all on or all off, to more sophisticated ways with kind of what's called task and ambient, so that maybe the ambient light's lower and people use task lights as they need to and get the amount of light they need for whatever the task is. But so that we get a finer grain, control of our space and also kind of ownership of it is important. And part of that is, a feedback loop, too. I think when people have a more direct understanding of that this behavior leads to this much power usage, I think that helps inform people and helps change behavior as well.
Do you foresee any... Let me step back. We know that the European Union has prohibited the sale, which I suppose also means the production, of incandescent lamps of 100 watts or greater. And they're moving towards a total ban on incandescent Edison-style A lamps. A, for those of you who are civilians, being our familiar sort of pear-shaped lamp, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So do you foresee the political will in New York City to do likewise and just simply ban the sale of Edison-style incandescent lamps? I mean, wouldn't that just be the way to make sure that we don't run out of power?
Yeah. Well, actually, it was signed by Bush, part of the Bush administration, was passing. It was kind of coming about it at the other direction. It was more like the way we enforce the mileage.
We're talking W or HW here?
W.
Okay. All right.
The way we enforce the CAFE standards, so by forcing the auto industry over time, giving them stretch goals that by whatever it is 2050, all cars their fleet's going to have to be at 40 or 50 miles to the gallon. So they did a similar thing with bulbs, but now they haven't outlawed incandescence. They've just said that starting with the 100 watt bulb, those lamps will have to reach a certain level of efficiency, which essentially, it's almost impossible to reach with your standard, light bulb, the household 100 watt light bulb, but a halogen, which is very similar to that, the high efficiency halogens, there's some that can meet that, and it phases in over time to 75 watt bulbs and 60 watt bulbs and so on. So they're actually requesting the manufacturers to make more efficient bulbs.
Is this a federal regulation already?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what you're saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Huh. And who's enforcing that?
I believe that comes through DOE. I'm not sure what the enforcement mechanism is, but...
Interesting. So... So we can save a lot of money, and that's certainly a great incentive to everybody, because nobody likes having a high Con Ed bill. But what I'm more interested in myself as an architect is how you're going to get your message out to the out to today's children who've grown up in a hyper illuminated environment to understand that in not so distant past times. Children went to school and they didn't turn on the lights until it was actually kind of dark, or if it was a cloudy day.
You know, it's interesting. I think the schools, the kids in schools are moving on this much more faster than the rest of us. I think there's some interesting organizations out there that are kind of the Green Schools Alliance here that are making these challenges, and schools are now competing really more sustainability more broadly, but it definitely includes a big component of energy efficiency. And Solar One, I think, is raising a lot of doing training in the K through 12 and going into the classrooms and making people.
For those of you outside of New York, Solar One is. Well, tell us about Solar One.
Well, Solar One's a local nonprofit, kind of like-minded organization to Greenlight New York. They do a lot of green jobs training, and they also do a lot of awareness, both in the schools and just in the population in general, about the benefits of solar energy and sustainability more broadly. So,
and isn't their headquarters like on a barge or something?
Yeah, it's called Stuyvesant Cove Park. It's I think it's about 23rd Street, all the way over on the East River. They have a small space which they expand in the summertime with a larger tent. But that's kind of a living lab and demonstration project for solar energy. And then they do a lot of the training out into the schools. But I think what you find, especially then there's this Green School Alliance, so you get a lot of these schools competing with each other on how green they can be. And I think the kids get it. They get that they're inheriting this planet that is going to be a big challenge, and that there's we need to pay attention to it. What I find is a lot of the people more, kind of in my generation or my age, are a little bit less tuned in, and I think we're more likely to do things like we've done before, especially in the architectural, in design community, if you will, in the construction community more broadly, to do it how it's tried and true, it's not going to rock the boat, you're not going to have grumpy clients because something didn't work. And I think getting those folks to change habit, I think, is actually more difficult. And one of the interesting things that happened as part of Plan YC, the mayor's master plan, was they focused on creating a series of new legislation called the Greener Greater Building Plan. And four laws came out of that, which were signed into law in 2010. One got rid of a loophole in the energy code where partial renovations didn't have to meet the energy code, which is, almost all of New York City in some way. Then they also passed something called a lighting upgrade and submetering bill, which really focuses on big commercial buildings. And that means by 2025, all of these so-called buildings over 50,000 square feet, non-residential buildings, will have to upgrade all of their lighting, tenant lighting, public lighting, interior, exterior lighting, to meet code that's in place at the time of the upgrade. And that affects about 1.25 billion square feet of space. And then the other thing that the other parts of the laws that are very interesting is there's a retro-commissioning every 10 years, building has to go through retro-commissioning, which basically means it has to kind of get a tune-up and tune up its system so they're working, more efficiently and see if there's opportunities for going beyond that. And then the other thing is every year now these big buildings over 50,000 square feet, which is a huge part of 45% of New York City's floor space, will be benchmarking their energy usage so that you'll be able to, as part of public record, go and look up these buildings and see what their energy usage is. And I think just by putting what's equivalent of a miles per gallon sticker on all of our buildings, that will start to play into building valuation, I think occupancy satisfaction, tenancy, and all sorts of issues. And because if you don't really understand what it is, you don't know. But once you start to understand what the energy usage is, I think it can, you know, it can spur action, and it can make those of us who are less likely to be tuned into, you know, more efficient lighting or the systems that you can install now to save tons of money on your energy bill. I think it'll help move that needle more quickly.
Absolutely. Just for the record, to identify your cohort, if I may, when did you graduate from high school, Richard?
I was class of 81.
Oh, my God. You're so young. I was a class of 70.
Great.
which means that I'm the tail end of the original advocates of the Bucky Fuller Spaceship Earth, first time around, Whole Earth catalog kids. I was at the first birthday celebration in Union Square.
Yeah.
And we're just totally radical, you know, hippie, turn out the lights people. You know, we just as soon just sit there in the dark with a candle. a beeswax candle, of course.
Yes. Cast in the sand.
And then turn on any lights because it just seems so wrong. Because we just expect Armageddon and gloom and doom coming in on us. So I have to say, speaking on behalf of my generation, we're totally prepared for this hurricane because we know that it's only going to last for 36 hours. And, you know, we've got our spam and we've got our batteries and we've got our shortwave radios and we're cool. This is Burlingame House and we're speaking with Richard Yancey, director of Greenlight New York, talking about ways in which we can save energy, which sometimes just ain't there. Let's go back to the possible decertification of Indian River up there just on the outskirts of Garrison, New York. Mm-hmm. That would be pretty bad for us in New York City, wouldn't it?
Well, it'll be a real challenge because I think New York City, I can't remember what the statistic is, but it's a huge portion of our energy basically is coming from Indian Point. And the other issue with it in terms of our carbon footprint, New York City's carbon footprint is relatively per capita low, partially because of Indian Point. So you know, I think, but that's not to say it's at all insurmountable. I think a lot of, you know, there's a lot of potential efficiency within our system that are just opportunities that we need to take advantage of. And, you know, that through, you know, through behavior and through creating more efficient buildings, we have a huge opportunity to reduce our energy usage and reduce our demand. You know, I think New York is unique in that respect because if you look across the country, a typical, you know, kind of like a city like Seattle, I think the carbon footprint of its buildings is only about 30 or 35%, where in New York City, the carbon footprint of our buildings is nearly 80%. And our buildings are not operating nearly as efficiently as they could have. So there's huge opportunities, lots in the lighting that we're talking about, but lots in the other systems in the building, the mechanical systems, the cooling, the heating. So there's these huge opportunities for, you know, efficiencies within our buildings that if we start to capitalize them, we can really reduce our, you know, our energy demand significantly.
That is a really, Richard, that is a really disturbing statistic that you just cited. What the heck are they, using energy on in Seattle, if not their buildings? I don't get it.
Transportation.
I would think that energy use would be scalable and be constant all the way up from a, you know, dispersed to a, I would think that energy use in buildings would be higher in Seattle than in, or is that what you said, than in New York, because we've got more density.
Yes, it's we have more density, and we have, you know, a great transportation infrastructure that we've, you know, that we've inherited from generations previous. Whereas the transportation infrastructure in a city like Seattle is predominantly still, you know, individuals in cars, in automobiles.
So that doesn't get counted in the city's energy use?
Oh, it does, but it's only if you look at it's. I think it's transportation in New York City is like 11% of our carbon footprint.
Uh-huh.
So it's a very small piece of that pie.
Okay.
Whereas in Seattle, it's a much larger piece of the pie.
So if we look at the energy per capita of a dispersed place. Versus, I'm guessing that Manhattan is probably the most dense, although there are parts of San Francisco that are probably pretty dense, right?
Yeah.
That our energy use per capita is probably the lowest, unless you're... looking at people who in Appalachia who probably don't use much energy at all because they're just not living very comfortably. And there may even not be metrics for them. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, no, the per capita in New York City, I don't know if it's the lowest, but it's certainly it's one of the, I think it's almost one of the lowest, if not the lowest, per capita kind of carbon footprint per capita. And that's directly, you can draw a direct line between the density of the square footage of buildings here, the, you know, the kind of mixed use of residential and commercial, you know, live-work within a very short radius, and then a very, you know, robust subway public transportation system and a very robust commuter rail transportation system, too, that feeds all these people into this, you know, into the downtown core. Create, you know, I think a real efficient machine for people to live and work and play.
Yeah, theoretically, I'm very close to my workplace, but it's 4.3 miles, and tomorrow, because the subway is not going to be running, I am not so sure that I want to take my bicycle down there and then take the crapshoot of can I actually ride back in hurricane wind 4.3 miles home? Because usually I just take the one train. It's a nice 20-minute ride, and you know, the motorman knows the way.
Well, it was pretty amazing when the transportation strike was, you know, that was, what, 4 years ago, something like that? How many people did... You know, a lot of people carpooled or took to cars, but a lot of people did take to their bike and walk also.
Which is one of the advantages of a dense urbanization.
Yeah. And I must say that the work that the city's done in really focusing on bike lanes over the last several years and increasing... bike lanes throughout the city, making it much safer to bike. You know, I think although the number of ridership has gone up tremendously, the number of incidents has gone down actually tremendously of accidents from, you know, that involve bikes. So it's very exciting to see the city become, you know, much more pedal powered, friendly, and robust. It's a great way to see the city.
Yeah, it's very exciting to me because I being a great history buff, have read up on the story of cycling, and in the 1890s, it was the Federation of Wheelmen who demanded better roads because the cyclists of that era
were fairly high-profile, shall we say, jocks. And they wanted nice macadam flat roads, and they were apparently incredibly terrorizing everybody else. They were just rushing past, you know, on their bicycles. And then we get into our current generation and our current Department of Transportation Commissioner, Jeanette Sadiq Khan, you know, is reviled by those who love their cars because of all of this proliferation of bike lanes. And, you know, I've cast my own vote in favor of no cars, having moved from beautiful rural Connecticut here into Manhattan and having sold my automobile. And, you know, I don't miss it at all.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I mean, it's been amazing to see not only just the bike lanes, but taking back some of the public space, too, just by painting it a different color and putting some, you know, planters and some tables out into the middle of these kind of, you know, asphalt wastelands. They've become these kind of thriving social public, you know, part of the public square.
Yeah, what you're talking about is the interruption of Broadway, starting at Times Square and then continuing at Herald Square, which pretty much forces most traffic to have to take 7th Avenue and just avoid that whole stretch from 46th or 47th Street all the way down to about 33rd Street. And all I could say is, you know, what do you have against Broadway? I mean, really, you know, Broadway being diagonal like that is historical and it seems efficient, but yeah, it has created all these impromptu urban piazzas,
mm-hmm.
which are kind of wonderful. Let's get back to...
Absolutely.
By now, I am sure that anyone who is listening to this live streaming broadcast or who will be listening as a podcast who is a civilian, we've long lost them. But if we haven't lost them, on an individual level, I'd like to talk about what you can do and... One, you know, plus one consideration. There's a German institute that says that the electromagnetic fields generated by compact fluorescent lights, anything that oscillates in response to lighting is exceptionally unhealthy. I'm sure that you know about this, right?
Talk to me a little bit more about what you're referring
to. Well, let's start with what can you do in your house, and then if you have any sort of lamp in your house that uses an oscillation of mercury, which any fluorescent source, I mean, does your organization have a take on that? Let's start with what can you do?
Well, so you're talking really, you know, on a residential scale, what can you do individually? You know, because I think it's not just what you do at your house, it's also what you do at work, which really, when we talk about Greenlight New York, we're really focused initially, at least, more on the whole kind of commercial sector because it's the one affected by the laws and it's the biggest bang for the buck. But getting back to your question about what you can do individually, you know, I think a lot of it comes down to just what we were talking about earlier, you know, turning off lights you don't need. And then, so, because that's the most efficient light you can have. And then when you kind of take the next step is to change out your inefficient lighting to be much more efficient. So that can be by changing out to, you know, compact fluorescent bulbs. And, the amount of mercury is relatively is really very, very small. And when you compare it to the amount of energy reduction you get from changing out that incandescent to the compact fluorescent, and knowing that a big chunk of that energy is coming from a coal-fired power plant, there's just no comparison to the amount of mercury spewing out from a coal-powered fire plant to the amount of mercury that you just have to make sure gets disposed of correctly in compact fluorescent bulbs. So,
that's a really key thing. I would hope that in your advocacy, because you've got imprimatur from the city, that you could be advocates for some way for the city to collect fluorescent lamps of all sorts,
mm-hmm.
rather than having them going to the general waste stream.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably something that the NRDC, the National Resources Defense Council, should take up. But I would just throw that out.
It's a hassle, and you have to do it. And you know, to be a good steward, you should be doing it right. And not everyone is willing to do that. But I think the more and more
right now, if you put those in the recycling bin, I don't know that they get recycled properly.
Well, the way you're supposed to be doing it is taking them to an organization, retail store. There are quite a few, Lowe's, Home Depot, others, that collect them and then properly dispose of them. So there are retail outlets out there that, many of which are convenient, that actually take all this stuff in. I think getting back to your point, so I think you can just put more efficient, lamps into your existing lights. So turn off the lights more, use only the amount of light you need, and get more efficient lamps into your lights. And, it's really interesting to be watching what's coming down the pike in terms of solid-state lighting or LEDs, because, DOE is really pushing this because it has this hugely transformational opportunity, and I would say that we aren't at a tipping point at all yet, but we are at a point where it's starting to become, you start to see it a little bit more in kind of mainstream residential or commercial use, and it's accelerating really rapidly in terms of replacing sockets with LEDs. And there, the efficiency is really incredible on the good products. You have to beware that there's a real inconsistency about good products and bad products out there when it comes to solid state lighting. But the energy savings is huge, just huge.
That's good to know. I think that we've about spoken more than any other conversation has ever possibly run on Burning Down the House, because we had no musical breaks. And do you have any parting words of wisdom for our listeners?
I think this stuff is not easy. I think light is this amorphous, interesting medium that, when you have a good light in there, things can be beautiful. And when you don't, the same thing can be dreadful. And, it has a huge effect architecturally. I think it has a huge effect on us emotionally, and it has a huge effect on us, from a productivity point of view. And it's not straightforward as to what's right and what's wrong or how best to do this. But what we do know is that there is a huge opportunity for energy savings through our lighting. And so it's absolutely imperative that we take advantage of that and that we do it in a way that gives us better spaces, not worse spaces. So really, and I think that possibility is really there, and it's an exciting opportunity.
And will you be leading the effort to educate people as to how to have good light?
Yeah, I mean, Greenlight New York will have classes there. We already are starting to roll out some of our classes with partnering with the AIA New York Center for Architecture on LaGuardia Place. And, you know, that's really focusing on a lot of the new laws and the new energy code, also on lighting controls and on lighting retrofits, you know, ways you can save money by putting in more energy-efficient lighting. And we will continue to expand, you know, the offering as we move into our space and really ramp it up. So I think, you know, getting back to your point, Curtis, early on, I think education is really the key to all of this. I mean, I think, you know, the technology is not the thing that's going to save us at the end of the day. You know, we have some very efficient technology. It's really behavior and understanding, I think, that really has got to be a lot of the focus of our efforts.
I totally agree. I, being of the class of 1970, grew up with classrooms where the teacher didn't turn on the lights until it was dark outside. And somehow I learned to read, although it possibly wrecked my eyesight. But maybe my eyesight was wrecked already from birth.
We as humans...
I remember classrooms that were a little bit less bright than, you know, our current offices. And yet, I could read, and we could talk about what we were reading, and that wasn't so very long ago.
Well, we're incredibly adaptable. I mean, we can go anywhere from full sunlight at, you know, which is just insanely bright from, you know, a lumen perspective to being able to read a newspaper by moonlight. So, you know, the range of the, you know, our ability to be productive and operate in widely different light levels is there. And it's just a question, I think, of being willing to you know, understand what the appropriate light level is for any given task that you're doing and not use more light than you need to do that.
Right. You've just pegged it. Be willing to be aware of how much light you really need. I think it's time to close out this episode. We've been talking with Richard Yancey, director of Greenlight New York. I'm Curtis DeWayne. This has been Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.